This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, the story of one of the most effective health care reformers of the 20th century, Marty Mann. Marty Mann was an alcoholic who worked tirelessly to teach the public about the nature of alcoholism. She saw alcoholism as a public health problem and as a treatable disease. In fact, Mann, who was one of the first women to belong to Alcoholics Anonymous, is credited with introducing the terms alcoholic and alcoholism into the standard lexicon. Our guests today are Sally and David Brown. They are the authors of a biography of Mrs. Marty Mann, the first lady of Alcoholics Anonymous. The Browns are a research and writing team. Sally Brown has recently retired from a career in recreational therapy and hospital chaplaincy. David Brown is a retired computer scientist. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, use this number, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else where it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. David and Sally Brown's book, A Biography of Mrs. Marty Mann, the First Lady of Alcoholics Anonymous, is published by Hazelden. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. David and Sally Brown, good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Yes, how do you do?
Good afternoon. We're pleased to be here.
Well, I'm pleased to talk with you about this remarkable woman. Before Marty Mann came along and started talking about alcoholism as a disease, how were people with a serious chronic drinking problem viewed?
It was regarded as a moral weakness, even a sin. The public just didn't understand that there was more to it than a lack of willpower, so that any person who suffered from becoming a drunk or inebriate was ostracized to some degree by society, and some of the worst offenders became skid row bums.
And it was even worse for women. A woman was socialized to always be a lady. We still are today. And women, for example, until Prohibition came in 1920, women wouldn't even go to bars unless you were, you know, a prostitute or somebody like that. And for women to become alcoholics was just, that was the worst thing that could possibly happen.
And before Marty Mann found herself in dire straits, or as she was finding herself with a very serious problem with alcohol, before she got into AA and was on her way to recovery, would those views of the day have affected her? The stigma of being a drunk and then being a woman who was a drunk?
More than that, they affected her because she didn't know what was happening to her. She didn't understand that her drinking was related to her inability to maintain friends, maintain a job, do the things she used to be able to do. She wanted to be able to drink the way she used to be able to drink, in moderation, and she just couldn't do it. She thought, she didn't realize that there was a connection between alcohol and her condition. She was afraid she was insane and would go to a psychiatrist to get a diagnosis, and most of them would just tell her that there was nothing they could do for people like her.
And she was very ashamed of what was happening to her, but she wouldn't talk about it to anybody. And people, you know, would tell her sometimes, "Marty, you're drinking too much. Can't you go back to drinking the way you used to?" And she just couldn't do it. And she was, she would gradually be shunned by one group after another. She moved in very high social circles, so she had lots of groups to choose from as she worked her way down to the Bowery in New York eventually.
When did she begin drinking?
When she was 17. And it's a typical age for adolescents to pick up a drink. Her family always had liquor in the house, and her father, as a matter of fact, was an alcoholic, though she didn't recognize that for a long time. And they were very wealthy, so they had any kind of liquor you could possibly want. And it just was the custom. And when most teenagers pick up a drink, they do not turn into alcoholics. Maybe 10 to 20% of them will eventually. But most people are just, you know, they enjoy liquor for what it is and don't get out of control with it. So she just started like any teenager, and it was the height of prohibition, where there were speakeasies, and she had lots of rich boyfriends, and everybody, all the boyfriends, had a silver flask, and it was easy to get into the speakeasies, and in fact, in the speakeasies, the cops got their drinks free. This was in Chicago. So there was lots of liquor available, both in her home and outside the home. And she discovered very quickly that she had a tremendous capacity for alcohol. Later, she recognized that that was an important early sign for many alcoholics. And she could drink almost anybody under the table and not particularly show the effects of it. So it never occurred to her that she would have a problem with alcohol. And for 10 years, this went on. And then suddenly it changed, and the disease part of the of alcoholism began to take over her life.
Hmm. Yeah, you write a story about her ability to hold her liquor as a young woman in the book, where she and some friends had a contest.
Wasn't that something?
And it was between Marty Mann and a friend of hers, a woman by the name of Virginia, if I'm recalling correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, this was the 1920s, and there was $5,000 on the table.
Yeah, which is a lot of money today.
And tell us what happened that night.
Well, what happened was that because of her legendary capacity for liquor and Virginia's legendary capacity, all the fellows decided to make bets on which of them would go under first. So they had a party at the house of a friend, and they proceeded to set up a full bar, and everybody who came to the party could drink whatever they wanted to, except for the three judges and Marty and Virginia. And the three judges couldn't drink anything. Marty and Virginia could drink whatever they wanted, but they were monitored by the three judges so that if the judges saw them throwing drinks out the window because they couldn't drink anymore, or if they were cheating in some way, then the contest would be over and the other girl would win. Well, the judges stayed sober, and Marty and Virginia drank and drank and drank, and nothing happened, and everybody else got drunk and passed out and got sick. And finally, at 5 o'clock in the morning, after this rather wild drinking party, Marty and Virginia were still on their feet, and so were the three sober judges, and so they all went out for breakfast.
And then you say...
And it was a tie.
And then you say, after breakfast, Marty and Virginia got down to what you term some serious drinking.
Oh, yes.
That's the story, anyway.
Boy. You say, we talked a little bit about her family being wealthy and prominent and upper middle class, if not upper class. Her father was made a lot of money, was for a time before he lost it, through drinking and poor choices and a compulsive gambling problem.
Yeah.
He was a multimillionaire. And I want to give folks just listening just a little bit more background on Marty Mann. She was born in 1904, and she began drinking during Prohibition. I think that that's important to keep in mind. Also, I want to ask the two of you about the historical influences that had an impact on her life. Her family and her social class, of course, shaped her. But also there were two historical influences that you think had an impact on her life: America's drinking culture and the temperance movement. Mm-hmm. You want to explain? You want to talk about that? David, do you want to take that?
America's social drinking and what was the other one?
And the temperance movement.
Oh, sure. Marty was in a social environment where her parents drank and the friends of her parents drank, and culture in Chicago and a good many other places during Prohibition was to find alcohol and drink it as a matter of normal social behavior. This was the kind of partying group that Marty would go out with and socialize. So it was the acceptable thing to do. And it's still pretty much the same even today. The temperance movement, which got started in the previous century, led by women's groups who were offended by the behavior of men who would abandon their families and or treat them with abuse, began to organize and try to control this out of control drinking, especially among men, fathers, and heads of families. And they began to campaign for this in church groups, one of the few places where they could organize and begin to have some voice. Their desire to change society and have a voice for change was one of the factors that led to the suffrage movement, to give women a vote, in fact, so that alcohol and the vote for women are intimately related in our history.
It should be noted, too, that it wasn't just Marty's social milieu in Chicago that was a drinking culture. The United States, America, from its very beginning, has been a drinking culture. They brought this from England and Germany and other parts of Europe, where beer and wine were standard with meals. And it was just, you know, a certain smaller percentage of people who would go out of control with this. And partly drinking was because you couldn't trust the water to be pure. The other thing about the temperance movement is that because it was centered in the churches and because it was centered around the substance of alcohol, the temperance movement believed that if you removed alcohol, then all would be well. They didn't understand that the compulsion would lead the person to find alcohol someplace else. So the temperance movement was in favor of shutting down bars, shutting down liquor stores, any place where you could buy liquor.
It didn't work. Our guests this afternoon are Sally and David Brown. I'm going to give Sally an opportunity to get a sip of water or something. She's recovering from a cold. David Brown and Sally Brown are our guests this afternoon. They are the authors of a biography of Mrs. Marty Mann, the First Lady of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. I want to get back sort of to the first question I asked, and that was about Marty Mann. Before she came along and started talking openly about alcoholism as a disease, it was quite a stigma to be branded a drunk or an inebe for inebriated. And she managed to turn that around. And I want to talk with you about how she was able to do this, what made her the woman she was in terms of being able to stand up and address this issue, the stigma issue. And before she dealt with the stigma of being a woman who was an alcoholic, she had to cope with another stigma as a young woman, as a girl, really. And we don't, when people hear me say what this is, they're going to be very surprised. The stigma of tuberculosis. It is very difficult in our day and age to think of tuberculosis as stigmatizing, but it was in Marty Mann's day when she contracted it as a girl. Why was TB stigmatizing, and how did that experience affect her?
There is certainly a parallel between her experience with tuberculosis and alcoholism. At the time she came down with tuberculosis, the whole nation was in a tuberculosis epidemic, and many thousands died from the disease of all social strata. But it was not understood. No one knew what caused it, where it came from. It was popularly believed to be associated with bad sanitation, bad living habits, or people who weren't doing things properly or well. They weren't clean. So that was why the stigma was attached to it. Marty tells the story of being sent off to a sanitarium in California where the air was clear and pure, so she could recover. And a friend, a little girl next door, was hidden away by her family, and she died of the disease. And that taught Marty a lesson that ignoring or stigmatizing the disease can have disastrous consequences. She, let's go back to the question at hand.
One of the things that really impressed us about that whole history of Marty's tuberculosis, she contracted it when she was 14, and she didn't really come out of it until she was 17, when she did begin drinking at that age. Anyway, she was very lucky because her family had so much money that they could afford the best treatment for her, and they were willing to find treatment for her. And when Dave talked of her being sent to this wonderful sanitarium in Los Angeles, people can't believe when we tell them that it in Los Angeles, it's right out by Pasadena, where the air was gloriously clean and pure in those days. And it was around before 1920. So we can imagine, you know, what that must have been like for her to be in isolation. There was no treatment except bed rest, good nutrition, lots of sunshine, and clean air. That's how they thought people's lungs would recover. And a cure for alcoholism was not discovered until the later 1930s. So So people,
do you mean a cure
for generation had a hard time?
Yeah. You mean a cure for tuberculosis?
I mean a cure for tuberculosis, pardon me, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, she did recover, but she knew that she had to maintain certain behaviors, which she largely ignored for the rest of her life. She had to eat properly and get good night rest and not put herself through a lot of stress. Well, she just wasn't made that way. And so she was always in danger of the disease raising its head again. And it did once briefly when she was a young woman. But then apparently she had it under control for the rest of the time. And we don't know whether she took medications for it after medications were discovered in the 1930s.
Mm. Another potential stigmatizing event in her life was the divorce from her husband, John Blakemore. Did that also have an effect on her ability later in life to stand up and say, my name is Marty Mann, I'm an alcoholic?
That's an area where I don't think we really know what was going on inside her. The marriage was a brief one, a matter of months, and her family disapproved of the marriage. She soon realized it was a bad choice. Her husband was drinking too much. He was abusive. She, I think, in a short time worked through that for herself, that this was something she ought to get out of as soon as possible and get on with her life and put it behind her. So she kept it a secret, really. She called herself Mrs. Marty Mann. Marty was her maiden name.
Mann was her maiden name.
Marty Mann was her maiden name. But she never talked about the marriage, and she didn't bring it up, really.
Well, the marriage was a fiasco from the start. Here, the drunk couple had eloped after Mardi Gras to down in Louisiana to get married, and she soon discovered that her husband, though he was charming and wonderful, and his family had lots of money just like hers, that she was not going to put up with his drinking and his abusive behavior, violent behavior. And that was very unusual in those days. In fact, many times it's unusual these days. Women will put up with a lot. But she had an economic cushion. That was a very important thing that does not happen for a lot of women today. She had an economic cushion, his money and her family's money, to fall back on, so that if she left him, she wasn't destitute. They also had no children, of course. Too soon for that.
Mm.
And she had the personality all her life of a leader. And if she was accustomed to standing up for herself in fairly ladylike ways, but definitely standing up for herself, so it's not too surprising that she did leave him, and it did set her free to become a full-time drunk herself.
Hmm. Now, there was one other area of her life where she must have felt the power of social stigma. Over time, she found herself attracted to women. She discovered she was a lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
And that part of her life she kept private. Perhaps that also helps explain Mrs. Marty Mann.
Yes, I think you're right.
Yeah. I'm wondering, though, was she more open about that later in her life?
She was never open about that, I would say. When we were talking with people she had worked with, professional colleagues, most of them would, when we told them she was a lesbian, they would deny it. They didn't believe it. So she was able to conceal it very well, even with persons she worked with professionally. Some very close associates, like, say, her secretary in the office, would find out or be told, and that was okay. There was also a lesbian, perhaps lesbian and gay community in Manhattan, where apparently she was known and open about her sexual orientation, and where she met other lesbians.
Yeah.
We know that she did vacation at a gay and lesbian village on Fire Island, a place called Cherry Grove, and that was where we really found documentation of her sexual orientation.
If she hadn't kept this part of her life private, it seems to me she wouldn't have been as effective in what she did. I don't know that people would have listened to her.
I agree completely. Both of us do. It would have been the kiss of death for her to have acknowledged that she was a lesbian. And it was bad enough to be a woman alcoholic. That was, it's impossible for us to, I think, appreciate the weight of that stigma back in her time. And it's to her everlasting credit that she was able to turn this country around so that the stigma of alcoholism no longer rests as heavily on women or men, for that matter. It's just that drinking among men has been more accepted by society, not accepted perhaps by the immediate family around them, where they don't have a job and can't help support you anymore, or are abusive and distant, perhaps. But drinking among men has been accepted much more readily than it, that is, alcoholism among men, much more readily than it ever has among women. Anyway, Marty never tried to conceal, I don't think, her lesbianism among lesbians and gays, because that was where she found herself comfortable. And eventually she found a partner, a wonderful woman, a lesbian, Priscilla Peck, who became the art editor and art director of Vogue magazine. And Marty and Priscilla were partners, committed partners, for 40 years. They lived together. And everybody knew this, but it was not uncommon for straight women to live together either, particularly in the days during the 1930s, during the Depression. Actually, Marty and Priscilla didn't meet until later. But women often lived together to share expenses if they were single. And everybody would just assume, well, you're living together until a man comes along and you're going to get married.
Hmm. Well, now let's go back to her struggle with alcoholism. Her drinking became very serious in the early 1930s. Can you give us some idea of the pain and isolation that her drinking caused her?
She was living in England by this time. She had emigrated and was in London, and for a time thought she might even take out British citizenship. And all of a sudden, after 10 years of drinking, she was about 27 or 28 by now, all of a sudden her drinking passed some kind of boundary where it went totally out of control. Now, she always thought she controlled her drinking, and she could not understand why her willpower didn't work any longer. And very rapidly, she began to drink around the clock. And she found what typical alcoholics find in their drinking years, that things get worse and worse and worse. Finally, she couldn't keep a job. Finally, she had no money except for friends who would lend her some. She began to look awful, and she just went from bad to worse over the period, next period of 6 years while she was living in London. And finally, she decided that maybe she would go back to New York, where she had had a brief career before going to London, and see if maybe she couldn't get control of her drinking there, because she had been in control of it when she was in New York. So she takes the geographic and goes back, and what happens is that her drinking gets even worse for one more year, and she does end up on the Bowery. Even all her friends, her wide, wide circles of friends, wouldn't put up with her anymore. Her own family wouldn't put up with her anymore.
It was painful for her to see groups with which she socialized essentially turn her out. She was in public relations, journalism, publicity kind of work, and so meeting people and socializing was part of her job. And she recognized that that people were turning away from her, and this obviously hurt her.
She had no money to speak of. She would, her father, who was also pretty destitute most of the time because of his gambling, had moved to New York from Chicago, and she scrounged a quarter or so from him once in a while. Sometimes she could scrounge a quarter from her one of her sisters who lived in New York, and with whom she was otherwise very close to during her life. But sometimes a bartender would give her a drink. Sometimes the guys at the bar would stand treat for her. But she just looked awful. She felt awful. She was in constant despair.
Hmm. How did she find AA?
She went to doctors, to psychiatrists, trying to find out what was the matter with her. And finally, one prominent neurologist in New York City put her in his neurology ward at Bellevue and kept her there for 6 months, where she had a chance to dry out. He would see her once a week and really didn't know how to treat her. He just kept her dry. But he did arrange for her to be admitted to a very nice, elegant sanatorium for psychiatric cases in Connecticut, Blythewood. And there she met the medical director, Harry Thibault. She had she became Harry Thibault's patient and had daily sessions, therapy sessions with him. She was there for something like a year and a half. And towards the end of that stay, someone gave to Dr. Thibault a manuscript edition, a manuscript copy of the book Alcoholics Anonymous before it went to the printer for him to review. The Alcoholics Anonymous group was sending this manuscript around to doctors and clergy because they wanted to make sure that they would have the support of physicians and clergy, groups they thought would be important for referring individuals to Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, Dr. Harry Thibault thought this was just what Marty Mann needed. He read it and gave it to her, and she thought it was just grand, too. It explained what had happened to her. It was the first explanation she found reasonable and acceptable until she encountered the word God in the manuscript, and that turned her off, and she'd argue with Dr. Thibault about that. She finally threw a what might be called a spiritual awakening, accepted God, and Dr. Thibault arranged for her to go to her first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. There were only two meetings in the whole country then, one in Akron, Ohio, and another in Brooklyn, at the home of Bill and Lois Wilson. So Harry Thibault was set it up, told her what train to get, where to take a taxi, subway, and so on, and she showed up at the meeting in 1939, I believe it was, in April. And she was scared to death of meeting these strangers, the Skid Row bums she thought they would be. And it was a completely different kind of experience, mm-hmm. and she felt very much at home. And ever since that meeting, became a strong supporter and had a great love and affection for Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Dr. Tebow. At one point, she said to him, well, he had told her, well, you have to stop drinking. you can't drink. And she told him in response, she said, look, I don't like people who don't drink. And from there, she went on to Alcoholics Anonymous, where you quote her as saying, at her first meeting, she said about that first meeting, I could finish their sentences, they could finish mine. We talked each other's language. It was not a room of strangers. These were my people. I had come home. Now, from there, it was a couple of years before she would go on to found the National Council on Alcoholism.
Actually, it was 5 years.
5 years, okay. What happened in those intervening years, and then what led her to stand up and lead a public awareness campaign?
That's a very interesting period, and one where we had documentation was scarce, and people's memories were pretty much gone about that period. She went to work professionally. She worked as a fashion publicity person for R.H. Macy. She worked as a writer for ASCAP, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. And this was, as Sally said, about a period of about 5 years. During that period, she met her lifelong partner, Priscilla Peck, probably at Macy's, but we don't know that for sure. But while she was working in ASCAP and living with Priscilla, she says that one time walking down the street, she looked up and saw the windows of apartments on Park Avenue, apartments like the one she was living in, and she wondered how many persons behind those windows were lying ill in bed from alcoholism, the way she used to find herself unable to get out of bed because of the effects of alcohol. She had recovered by this time herself. She wanted to bring that recovery to others, and she, sometime later in the middle of the night, had a vision about how she could do this, and she got up and went to her typewriter and wrote a plan to educate the public about alcoholism. This was such a revelation for her, and she wanted others to know about it. She had a plan based on 5 points. You mentioned them earlier at the start. Alcoholism is a disease. The alcoholic is treatable. The alcoholic is a person worthy of treatment. It's a public health problem, and it's a public responsibility. She wanted to address those 5 points and do something about it, and education was the answer. So she set up the National Committee for Education on Alcoholism and got support of Yale University, Bill Wilson, Harry Tebow, and many others.
Can you give us an idea of the approach she would take when she got in front of an audience, Sally? Can you give us some idea of what she said and of how she was received?
It would depend on the audience that she had. If it were an audience of recovering alcoholics, they would be predisposed to be interested in what she had to say, because she was still considered, you know, the leader of women coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. If it were an audience of physicians, for example, especially in her earlier years, they would be very skeptical about who in the heck is this person talking to us. She's not a doctor. She doesn't have any letters after her name, no degrees. Marty had only finished, all she had had of college was 1 year of finishing school in Florence, Italy. So she, you know, compared with these physicians, she was uneducated. And who was she to be talking to them about a disease? They were supposed to be the experts in a disease. But the fact of the matter was, and they knew it, they didn't know much about alcoholism. Nobody knew very much about it. And she was setting out to educate them. And she was such a composed, dignified, charismatic speaker and a skilled orator who usually spoke without notes whatsoever, in perfect sentences, beautifully organized with a sense of drama and a sense of humor and of pacing and timing, that people were just enthralled. And no matter what attitude they had come in with at the beginning of her talk, they left with specific information and overwhelmed by the personality and the hope that this woman radiated.
Hmm. Why isn't her name widely known today?
Oh, that's such a good question. There are very few people, in fact, there are only two in the alcoholism movement whose names are still remembered, and those are the two co-founders,
mm-hmm.
Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith. He was the man from Akron, and Bill was the one from Brooklyn, New York. So it's not unusual for people's names to drop off the screen, but it is surprising, considering her contributions to the understanding of alcoholism, that her name has dropped off. That just happens sometimes, and part of the reason we wrote the book was to bring her name and her accomplishments back into public understanding and public perception, because she had so much that she accomplished that we can still continue to learn from that today in how to go about treating alcoholics, how to do intervention, how to provide education about alcoholism, how to provide treatment, how to provide aftercare, and so on.
I think also it should be mentioned that during her career, she was a woman among professionals that were largely male. They were male-dominated professions. And she always had a kind of secondary level position in that community, in Alcoholics Anonymous, in professions of medicine, clergy, whatever. Men, I think, were the powerful influences there, and that was one reason that her memory is not as strong as it should be.
What? Another reason, of course, is, if I can interject right here, is that she wasn't interested in having her name live after her. She was interested in getting the job done here and getting other people energized and educated to carry on.
Would it be fair to say that without her, Alcoholics Anonymous wouldn't have seen the successes it has seen?
Well, that's Dave's and my opinion. And we believe that in part because Bill Wilson himself and his wife Lois Wilson said that many times about Marty, that AA simply would not have gotten as far as it did without her sowing the seeds of understanding in communities, not only in this country, but in many other places around the world, so that people would understand. And you can't address an issue tuberculosis could not be addressed until whole communities were educated to understand how to approach and intervene with such a disease. And it has been the same with every scourging disease that we've had, whether it's cancer or tuberculosis.
Or AIDS.
AIDS or alcoholism. And incidentally, alcoholism and drug addiction are considered in the same breath these days and lumped under addictive disease.
And today the organization that she founded long ago is called the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence.
Correct. Now, she never would have liked the term drug dependence. For one thing, she didn't want, in her day, she didn't know what we know today, that the diseases are connected in the body. Research has shown that in the last 10 to 15 years and is showing more and more of it. And she would have gladly accepted that. However, she never liked the term dependence. She felt that that was a weak term that didn't begin to describe what happened to a person who was addicted.
We have to leave it there. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon about this truly remarkable woman. And I hope that folks will look for the book and read about Marty Mann.
Thank you very much. We always enjoy this.
Thank you for having us.
David and Sally Brown have been our guests this afternoon here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. They are the authors of a biography of Mrs. Marty Mann, the First Lady of Alcoholics Anonymous.